This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 12th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 443. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, what is going on in Ottawa? Whenever I want to answer that question, I go to the best source of federal government news coverage, Blacklock's Reporter. My guest is Tom Korski, the managing editor of Blacklock's Reporter. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. If you want to know what is going on in Ottawa, the best place to look is Blacklock's Reporter. That's blacklocks.ca. And joining me again on the podcast is managing editor Tom Korski, joining me from Ottawa to talk about federal issues and federal issues that affect the West Coast. Here we are in April of 2026. Prime Minister Mark Carney is on his way to a majority, slowly on his way to a majority a year after the election. Big question is, will Pierre Poilievre hang on as the Conservative opposition leader? The NDP has a new leader, Avi Lewis, who is determined to take the party further to the left. And of course, Justin Trudeau, he's happily on tour, a permanent tour it seems, with Katy Perry. So the big news this week in Ottawa, Conservative Marilyn Gladue became the fifth floor crosser, bringing the Carney Liberals ever closer to a majority. There's a by-election, three by-elections on April 13th. Which way do you think those will go, Tom?
Well, two of those are pretty solid Liberal seats. They're in Toronto, Bob, University, Rosedale, Scarborough, Southwest, both held by former Liberal cabinet ministers. It would be really astonishing of a meteor slamming into Earth if the Liberals couldn't pick those up. There's something wrong if they can't. Everyone thinks they will. And then the question becomes Terrebonne, which is a suburb of Montreal. Bloc held that for 10 years. Liberals got the narrowest win you ever saw by a single ballot in 2025 in Terrebonne. It was the closest election in, since 1963, overturned on irregularities by a Supreme Court order, which is rare but not unprecedented, very unusual. And the Bloc is expected to pick that up. So let's assume that the Liberals get two out of three on the by-elections and, of course, all the floor crossers you mentioned. That gives them 173 seats. That's a working majority, but it's pretty skinny, Bob. It's thin. 343-seat Commons. And so it is a green light for Cabinet to start doing whatever it wants. But it's not too comfortable. It's not a very pleasant majority. It won't be dull.
I mean, you've got this week Marilyn Gladue, who's got a background as being someone who actually helped Pierre Poilievre become the leader of the Conservatives in 2022. She expressed anti-vax and pro-trucker sentiments. How does she fit in with the Liberals?
She doesn't. She's a libertarian, really. I've known MP Gladue over the years, spoken to her. She's one of the really libertarian members of the Conservative caucus, has been for many years, and you get the sense that this was a highly personal decision when she spoke to a county weekly in her riding in Sarnia, Ontario. In 2025, she said she was counting on a Conservative win, hoped to get into a Poilievre cabinet, ran for the Conservative leadership 6 years ago, was not successful, obviously, and expressed some disappointment in the long and winding trail of political life. One had the impression that 10 years in opposition was starting to wear on MP Gladue, and that's the difference between winning and losing, isn't it, Bob? They're going into year 11. Conservatives have never lost four elections in a row, but they did in 2025. And there's a big difference between winning and losing, and it was too big for MP Gladue, who thought she would like to join the government caucus where she can vote for all those things she condemned as a libertarian MP.
Politicians like Marilyn Gladue were hoping to have some sort of power or be in some sort of power and have an extra paycheck, maybe at least as a parliamentary secretary under a Poilievre government, but that didn't happen. She very much expressed sentiments saying you can't trust liberals, just like New Democrat Lori Idlut from Nunavut, who is another floor crosser. And then, of course, there's the floor crossing of Michael Ma, perhaps the most controversial of them all. And, of course, he had a recent appearance at a parliamentary committee that got himself into trouble.
It was not successful. MP Ma inexplicably went to bat against a witness giving expert testimony regarding the use of forced labor, slave labor, in the People's Republic of China. This is documented widely, and by no less authority than the Parliament of Canada, which has twice since 2022 passed motions, one unanimously, one sponsored by a Liberal member, and one sponsored by a Conservative member, censuring the People's Republic for genocidal practices. It's not pleasant to talk about. We're all adults, Bob. But this is really atrocities targeting the Muslim Uyghur minority population in Xinjiang, northern province, including forced labor, forced abortion, organ harvesting, the worst concentration and forced enslavement in camps since the Holocaust, according to a House of Commons subcommittee in a report 5 years ago. Well, here was this expert witness testifying that Xinjiang slave laborers are some of the key producers of aluminum products in the world. They are a leading supplier for Chinese manufacturers, and in particular, of manufacturers of Chinese electric vehicles that Cabinet just granted a pretty hefty quota, starting at 49,000 battery electrics this year. That's about half the battery electric car market. It was quite a concession. Well, said MP Ma to a witness testifying, have you ever been to China? Well, yes, she said, I've been many times since 1970. Well, have you seen them, though? Did you see the slaves? And MPs on the Commons Industry Committee got extremely upset, sought to censure MP Ma. He subsequently gave a sort of a half-baked apology. But it was a clever and, frankly, astonishing performance to imply that somehow this was subjective. You know, you don't have to go to the North Pole to know it's cold, Bob. And you don't have to go to Xinjiang to know that there's atrocities in the People's Republic. But don't tell that to the MP for Markham Unionville.
Just looking back at the last 12 months in 2025 during the Elbows Up revolution, the Elbows Up campaign for the Liberal Party in the election, the snap election, he promised to get a deal with Trump and also promised to bring Canada closer to Europe. You know, trying to do two things, make sure that continentally there's some sort of deal with Trump to tamp down, if not get rid of the tariffs and get us closer to a new continental trade deal. The 2026 Carney has brought Canada closer to China, as well as India, further away from Trump. What will a majority Carney government do in 26 and beyond? Will Carney continue on this path to try to paint himself as kind of a red Tory, or might he revert to his net zero ideology that he was known for before becoming prime minister?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Bob, and it in fact is the question. They obviously desperately want a majority that was denied them by the electorate. That's not a controversial statement. But why? You know, bringing us closer to Europe, Bob, you're a young man, but I've been hearing that speech for 50 years. That's why we have the metric system, because there was an elder Trudeau who's going to bring us closer to Europe. And then when it comes to the collapse of the trade talks with the United States, you knew that was in trouble when they assigned a superannuated public employee, Janice Charette, former clerk of the Privy Council, literally out of retirement. She's never negotiated anything in her life. And they sent her down to the United States talks in Washington. Well, you know, that's not going anywhere. Why do they want that majority? Well, there have been ideas that have been floating around caucus for some time. But you need the votes, Bob, and they haven't had the votes since they lost their majority in 2019. What kind of ideas? Well, they've talked about censoring legal content on the internet. The internet scares me, said the former Attorney General, Arif Barani. He said that in testimony. We see now, once again, for the third time, but the first under a majority circumstance, cabinets talking about censoring, regulating legal content on the internet. We've heard talk from caucus members about lowering the vote to 16, but they could never get the votes. But there's no point in having a majority if you plan to keep doing what he's doing, which has been really over-promising, under-delivering. I refer to the prime minister. They must want those votes for something. I'm not trying to be conspiratorial, but hang on to your hat, because it's not going to get dull. They have been chasing this for years, Bob. They have to get that majority. I wonder why. We're going to find out.
And BlackRock's reporter has been not only keeping an eye, a close eye, on Prime Minister Mark Carney, but also the Minister of Finance, François-Philippe Champagne, who's been in the news. He was in the news for going to China, along with a delegation of other economic and financial experts, including the head of the Bank of Canada, Tiff Macklem. He's also not wanting to withdraw the money that Canada paid into the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, about $160 million U.S., and BlackRock's had some news about that.
The Asian Infrastructure Bank, Bob, the cabinet kept the money in there, but they decided to boycott the meetings. Why didn't they just withdraw the money? So they have this circumstance where this is a sort of a weird half boycott. The taxpayers are still invested in what they have been told, a communist front by a fellow named Bob Pickard, who was their director of communications, a Canadian citizen. And he blew the whistle on what he said was really a communist party front that has served no infrastructure purpose, that did not serve the larger purpose of the Communist Party of China. And so cabinet, we see through internal memos to the Minister of Finance, doesn't have the guts to just take the money out, but won't deal with the issues. They did say there had been an internal investigation, but they wouldn't tell anyone what it said. That part of the memo was censored. This is not very forthcoming cabinet when it comes to hot issues, Bob.
The Finance Minister Champagne, his wife, has a very interesting job with the company that has about $90 billion of taxpayers' money to build a high-speed train.
Isn't that nice when that nice thing happened? Remind me of, actually, Phil Gilardi, the old days. Mm. God bless his heart, famous highways minister from the Okanagan, whose sons were believed to have profited from some highways work with the province, and gave an almost a tearful exclamation in the day with the social creditors, that why should my boys be disqualified from working on BC highways just because their pop is the highways minister? Well, you know, when you look at ethics that way, here was the Minister of Finance saying, why should my wife be disqualified from a successful career as a vice president with a taxpayer-funded railway, though she has no railway experience, just because I happen to be the Minister of Finance? But that's what happened. Mrs. Champagne landed a pretty sweet job as a vice president of what's called Alto Corporation. This is the crown agency that is mandated with a $90 billion budget to build a regional high-speed rail network that even people who live in the riding where the train track is going through don't want, let alone ratepayers in British Columbia are going to pay for it. And just as they were working out the funding, Mrs. Champagne got hired as a vice president. Well, Phil Gilardi would have no trouble explaining this one, unlike the Minister of Finance.
Questions, yeah, that should concern the Ministry of Finance and anyone that watches it, about the cost of the upcoming FIFA World Cup in Vancouver and Toronto. The costs have gone up, of course, in dealing with stadium renovations, temporary in Toronto and permanent renovations in Vancouver. And then there's the cost of security, which is a big question mark. We still don't have any clarity on that. But right now, there's no parliamentary budget officer. We're still waiting for the nominee to get officially appointed so that the job can be done. And I contacted the parliamentary budget officer office, and they told me that until that happens, they can't finish or release reports. And one of the reports they are working on is the cost of federal spending on the FIFA World Cup. Officially, it's about $320 million is the federal funding envelope. But again, security is a big question mark.
And no real-time auditing, Bob. That's the problem. Even with a budget office, it's typically after the fact. Why are they incapable federally of doing real-time auditing? That's others do that all the time. That's been a complaint for years, even going back to the era of pandemic overspending. They were told by no less an authority than a prosecutor at the Charbonneau Commission. That was the famous Quebec Construction Fraud Commission that sent many a mayor out of office in Quebec, and he said, get real-time auditing. In the case of the budget office, you're right, there was a gridlock. Cabinet had their pet appointee, happened to be a former Department of Finance manager. MPs wanted to keep the last two budget officers that they had, and they were real hellraisers. Yves Giroux and Jason Jakes was his name, was the last one, who was essentially terminated when his contract expired. Commons Government Operations Committee said at National Finance Committee, said, keep those men. We think those are good men for the taxpayer. Cabinet wasn't interested. They wanted their own appointee. Their appointee will get through, especially now. This is what happens when you have a majority, has to require a vote of the House and the Senate. They will get those votes. We'll see what happens. But I have to say, Bob, when budget officers are in early innings, they really only get their Irish up after they've been on the job and lied to for a few years. So keep your expectations low on this new budget officer for a long time.
It was really rolled out in BC before it became a national concern, a national program. $10 a day daycare. The government has skipped the daycare target. That is the headline in Blacklock's Reporter.
March 31 was their big deadline. I didn't set it. They set it 5 years ago. March 31st, 2026, marked the date. They would, for their $30 billion in subsidy payments, create 250,000 new child care spaces. Well, this is sad news. They did not create 250,000 new child care spaces for that subsidy. They didn't come within half of that. And they say in a briefing note that we see for the Minister of Social Development that was responsible for it, let alone Department of Finance, that budgeted for this, they don't really know why they missed the deadline by 50%. You know what they typically do, Bob, in the federal public service managers, they do this all the time. When you don't hit your deadline, you don't hit the target. Well, what you do is lower the target. It's sort of like a children's birthday party. You want everyone to be able to hit that target. And if the target gets low enough, well, doggone it, you can't help but hit the target. They missed this one by 50%. No accounting for it. They didn't even bother to set a new target. Funny, they didn't issue a news release. When it's bad news, they don't make the announcement, Bob.
Speaking of announcements, we're coming up next month on the fifth anniversary of that bombshell announcement from the Tkamloops First Nation in Kamloops, British Columbia, regarding what they said at the time were 215 graves at the Kamloops Indian Residential School that they said that they had determined through ground-penetrating radar. They walked back that statement not long after to say that there were 200 signals or signatures that indicated there could be something underneath. But Blacklock's Reporter has been really spearheading the drive to get information out of the government, to wrestle information out of the government through the Access to Information system, made appeals and got some documents. What did those documents say, and what are you looking at as we approach the fifth anniversary of this this major moment in Canadian history that so far has not yielded any evidence?
Well, we know, Bob, the feds approved payments of $12.1 million to the First Nation in Kamloops for field work, exhumation of remains, DNA and forensic testing, and we know through the documentation we've seen that none of that happened. The money went out. There was no deliverable, as to use the word of the bureaucracy. Nothing came back. We filed numerous access to information requests. I think we're now on our second or third round of appeals in which the information commissioner has so far issued repeated orders to the respondent departments, including the Department of Crown Indigenous Relations, to say, for the love of Mike, release the records or contest the order in federal court. So we always say in the newsroom, everything comes out eventually, and this will, but there's no doubt that the department is very hesitant to release the records, as is the First Nation. The chief you mentioned gave an extraordinary, may I say, appearance at the Senate Indigenous Peoples Committee This was on the 25th of March. It was a late night setting and evening session. And the chief mentioned that the search would take many years. And in fact said, I quote her accurately, Holocaust investigations have continued for more than 75 years. But then it got interesting, Bob. There was an MP from Manitoba, my home province, Mary Jane McCallum. She's a former residential school student, and she gave quite an emotional appeal to the chief. And I quote her accurately. She's talking about the purported 215 graves. She said they died there in violence. They were buried in violence. Need to take them home and honor them so they can be with their loved ones removed from that site. Do you agree that we need to start? And the chief would not reply. She said it all has always been for us either about exhumation or memorialization. We're working through those steps. End of quote. There was another senator from Alberta, Scott Tennis from Southern Alberta High River, highly sympathetic to First Nations in his home province, who said, how do you get to the truth? You talk about denialism. How do you get to the truth if you don't look for the remains? You have to look for the remains. They couldn't get a straight answer. Bob, this is not going to be, whatever some people envision that this is going to be forgotten or people are going to move on, this was a national ordeal. It really prompted weeks of national mourning. Cabinet famously lowered the Peace Tower flag for 5 months. But why? Because they said in an internal memo that we saw in the day, they had to find the heartbreaking truth. So let's find the heartbreaking truth. And that's where we are.
The Kamloops issued a news release back in February. The headline on that was update on ongoing investigation at former Kamloops Indian Residential School. When that was issued, I tried contacting Chief Roseanne Casimir. I had some questions, pretty simple questions. I wanted to know the name of the firm or the individual that conducted the LIDAR scan. When did it take place? And will you release the report? The other question I had was, what is the name of the firm or the individual that coordinated and performed the certified detection dog searches? Because that's what the report also said, that they had dogs sniffing around. And I wanted to know, when did those take place and will you release the reports? The response I got by email from Chief Roseanne Casimir was a simple one-liner. She said that at the request of the experts we engaged and due to the intense scrutiny directed at professionals involved in residential school investigations, we are withholding names. Didn't comment at all on the request for any of the reports. So here we are, almost 5 years later, none the wiser, except there has not been a dig for the remains. I question this because what if there are still people alive who might be culpable for any crimes against children?
Least of all the families. Exactly, Bob. We see through some minutes. At the First Nations Council meetings, early in the period where this discovery of the purported graves was announced, and there was discussion at meetings, and it was about families who said, remember so-and-so, and my mother said she had a brother, and he went to Kamloops, who we never heard from him again. Really anguished appeals. Senator Tanis got that bug. This is what he said. He said, this is the question I'm asking. How do you get to the spot where you say, okay, it's time for us to begin excavating and trying to start bringing people home? And the chief replied, it's going to be a long process. What did she say? 3 or 5 years. I definitely see it as a longer process. More than 3 to 5 years, it's going to take some time. Let's use plain language, Bob. There's 12.1 million reasons to recover those remains. That was the public funding. There's only one reason not to recover the remains or attempt to. And I think we know what it is. Because you know there's not 215 children buried in the orchard in Kamloops. I don't want to use blunt language, but that's the conclusion of federal agencies that we see in access to information memos. Parks Canada has, we've seen this and reported on it, has acknowledged that it is highly unlikely and merely purported that there are 215 graves. If the First Nation wanted a quiet time of reflection and wanted to spend years doing archival searches before they try to recover any remains, they shouldn't have taken $12.1 million federal dollars to recover remains. This is their problem today.
Speaking of accountability, the promises made by the Carney government during the election last year, the catchphrase was Build Canada Strong, and they've turned that slogan into brand names for new federal offices and more federal spending on infrastructure. Under Gregor Robertson, who's both the Housing and Infrastructure Minister, he made a political comeback last year during the election. Represents a riding in South Vancouver and part of Burnaby. Blocklock's actually had a story recently about Gregor Robertson, that few Canadians think Housing Minister Gregor Robertson is on the right track in addressing an affordability crisis, says in-house Privy Council research.
Well, his problem is you can't fool all the people all the time, though, Bob, it is true that they have not been successful anywhere close to the outcome that they predicted. What did Cabinet say? Cabinet said we need to double the housing construction in this country to get to a minimum 500,000 starts annually to restore affordability. And we're nowhere close to that. And in fact, the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, the federal insurer, has forecasted housing starts, which are in the range of about 230,000, so less than half of the minimum requirement for affordability, and next for a variety of reasons in local market conditions, not only in Lower Mainland and Victoria, but right across the country. Although we run across now, in that context, a really unfortunate memo from Minister Robertson's department to him, written by his deputy minister. There's an important, it's an asinine memo, forgive my language, but there's an important takeaway, Bob. What did the memo say? It's a briefing note to the ministers dated last September 3rd. We just see it now. And it attempts to redefine affordability. So help me, this is on the level. They said there's no housing crisis if you own a house. If you bought, honestly, if you bought a house 25 years ago, you're doing pretty well, said the memo. And it shows that generally, I quote this memo accurately, residents who own property and have for 25 years are able to manage their shelter costs quite beautifully. It's just the young people who can't get into the housing market. That's where the rubber hits the road. I don't know why the Minister of Housing did not throw his deputy down the stairs when he walked into his office with this ridiculous observation about the housing crisis. Bob, if this was from any other department or agency, it would merely be comically inept. But this is the housing department that's assigned to solving the housing crisis and is trying to find ways to say the housing crisis is not so bad because we can't solve it anyway. Who thinks that Gregor Robertson is going to get it done any more than his four predecessors? No, nobody.
When he was mayor of Vancouver, he famously promised in the 2008 campaign that if he got power, he would end street homelessness in Vancouver by 2015. And he also had to promise to make Vancouver the greenest city in the world by 2020. Well, what happened? Homelessness got worse. And there is no title for greenest city in the world. And he's trying to stake his brand on making housing more affordable and infrastructure better in Canada in federal politics. And so far, almost a year in, it's failing great on both.
This is the problem, Bob. Exactly. This is not a new government. They just call themselves that. They are 11 years in office. Even the prime minister got that vibe. You can't keep sloganeering and then underperforming and coming up with distractions. Carney said so. Here's a quote. This is the prime minister speaking, where he, in fact, appeared to express exasperation with that style of leadership where you give a beautiful performance off the teleprompter and then go back to sleep. I'm a serious person, said Carney. This is March 20, 2025. This is going into the election campaign. I'm a serious person. Voters expected results. This is what he said. They judge people on results and what they expect for those results, end of quote. Take it away, Minister Robertson. You promised 500,000 homes a year. When everybody in the building trades, let alone basic ratepayers, knew that was never going to happen, but you promised it. And then it got worse and not better. Ask CMHC. So where are the results, and is it time to judge? Can we now judge people on results? I'll just insert Housing Minister Robertson. Can we judge Minister Robertson on results and what people expect for those results, end of quote. This is the pressure that cabinet's under when you try to fool all the people all the time, Bob.
And speaking of results, a Black Fox reporter gets the results. You get the stories, get the goods. It's the go-to source for news on what's going on in Ottawa and what Ottawa is doing to the rest of the country. And thanks again for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast, Managing Editor Tom Korski. Where can people who listen to and watch the Breaker.News podcast find Black Fox reporter?
Well, thank you, Bob. We're at blacklocks.ca. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, KMT chair calls for peace as greatest gift during Shanghai visit. Speaking at Yangshan Deepwater Port, Kuomintang chairperson Cheng Li-Wen reflected on the city's history and transformation, describing Shanghai as both a place of cultural vibrancy and historical tragedy shaped by war and conflict. Cheng referenced wars in the 19th and 20th centuries, leading up to the KMT's retreat to Taiwan in 1949 after its defeat by the Chinese Communist Party. Quoting Canadian poet John McCrae and Chinese writer Lu Xun, Cheng underscored the high price of peace and urged continued dialogue and exchange, saying mutual trust must be built incrementally. In ABC News Australia, racism erupts after Melbourne announces Little India plans, but some Indians say it will build connection. Consultation on the plan has involved 15 community organizations and associations, the city of Melbourne said. Melbourne has the largest Indian population in Australia, with about 36% of all Indian-born immigrants in the country residing there, totaling more than 240,000 people, according to the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. In Kyoto News, Japan downgrades description of China in annual diplomatic report. The annual report, submitted by the Foreign Minister Toshimitsu Motegi at a cabinet meeting, refers to China as an, quote, important neighboring country, end quote, a step back from, quote, one of the most important bilateral relations, end quote, in the 2025 edition. The report said China has intensified criticism and coercive measures against Japan, citing incidents such as radar illumination by Chinese military aircraft, targeting SDF planes, and export restrictions on dual-use items to Japan. At the same time, it stressed that Japan remains open to dialogue.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In The Oregonian, how one Portland bar's ceiling sweep tradition has raised over $415,000 for sick children. Throughout the year, patrons of Kell's Irish Pub and Restaurant can donate to Providence's Center for Medically Fragile Children in a unique way. Bartenders use Irish magic to stick cash donations on the ceiling. Every year, staff and volunteers clear the ceiling and count what they've collected. This year, they raised $3,229. Co-owner Lucy McAleese recalls that the tradition started in the 1990s. In Cascadia Daily News, famed mountaineer Jim Whittaker, first American atop Mount Everest, dies at 97. Longtime Port Townsend resident inspired generations of alpinists, defined an active Northwest outdoor lifestyle. The historic ascent on May 1, 1963, catapulted Whittaker, who died peacefully at home with family April 7th in Port Townsend at the age of 97,
to the pinnacle of fame as a genuine 20th century American folk hero. He was the first full-time employee of Recreational Equipment Incorporated, REI, and later its chief executive, and a close friendship with former Senator Robert F. Kennedy. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Exclusive: police search Vancouver cell phone repair store. And exclusive: NDP's former interim leader takes off to the U.S. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the people in hard hats and high-vis vests on construction sites around British Columbia. April is Construction and Skilled Trades Month in BC. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 12th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 12th of April in 1955, Dr. Jonas Salk's polio vaccine was declared safe? And in 1980, Terry Fox began his Marathon of Hope in St. John's, Newfoundland. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.